Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. We would like to thank Dr. George Lundberg and the Lundberg Institute for their consistent support of club programs on issues in healthcare, including today's event. I am Dr. Alice Chen, Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and Chief Integration Officer at San Francisco General Hospital, and your moderator for today's program. So our guest today is Dr. Atul Gawande, who is a surgeon at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, professor at Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health, staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, and a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship. He's the author of three previous New York Times bestsellers, The Checklist Manifesto, Better, and Complications. In his new book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End, Dr. Gawande turns his attention to his most important subject yet, how despite incredible technological advances and impressive gains in life expectancy, medicine is failing those who are at the end of their lives. Full of wonderful storytelling, thorough research, and cogent insights, Being Mortal asserts that medicine can and has the responsibility to not only ensure health and prolonged survival, but to enable well-being even in the face of debility and death. Please welcome Dr. Atul Gawande.
Thank you all for coming out. It's really great to be here on a beautiful sunny day to talk about death. I start out the book by pointing out that I learned about a lot of things in medical school, but mortality wasn't one of them. When we were in our medical training, I think our perspective and our professor's perspective was that what we needed to learn how to do was understand, you know, disease and then how to fix it. And, you know, we all went into medicine because we wanted to fix. That's how you felt competent, is you fixed problems. But when I got into practice, I found that many of the problems that people were bringing to me were ones I couldn't fix. People with chronic illnesses that were getting worse. People who were dealing with frailty and problems of aging that weren't going away. Or terminal illness and mortality itself. And what I wondered along the way, and what I've been even writing about here and there in the books and essays I've done previously, was, you know, what would it mean to be competent at these problems? And I didn't feel like I was getting to very good answers. And along the way, I've also seen these problems arise in my family. I talk about my father becoming diagnosed as I was doing some of the investigations for this book. My father got diagnosed with a brain cancer that ultimately claimed his life 3 years ago now. The kinds of questions I would get that I would really struggle with were ones like the one I got when the husband of my 13-year-old daughter's piano teacher, Peg Batchelder, called. And he was, he called me out of the blue, but I'd been close to them as neighbors, as friends, and it's the kind of conversation you have with almost anybody at a certain point in their life. And he said, Peg is in the hospital. Now, I'd known that a few years back she'd been treated for a pretty tough cancer called a sarcoma. It's a rare soft tissue cancer that had arisen in the muscle of her pelvis, and she'd had to have a third of her pelvis removed and replaced with metal. She had chemotherapy, she had radiation, she had many complications. It was, she said, her year in hell. But she came back from it and had a great prognosis, no evidence of any disease left, and returned to teaching. She refilled her roster of students in no time. She was in her early 60s, this tall, lovely, incredibly graceful woman, a gentle taskmaster who the students loved because she somehow had this sense of just sheer enthusiasm about their successes at each little step along the way at getting better at what they were doing. Then about 3 years after her treatment, she was diagnosed with a leukemia-like malignancy caused as a side effect of her chemotherapy. She had to go on a different kind of chemotherapy, and she insisted that she keep teaching through that. Hunter, my daughter, would have, you know, be notified that we needed to move her lesson here or move her lesson there because of the treatments, but she kept on going. And then a couple of weeks went by where the lessons were just canceled, and that was when I got this phone call. Martin put Peg on the speakerphone from the hospital room where she was, and she had this halting, very quiet voice, long pauses between sentences, and she said that the treatment wasn't working. The blood counts from the leukemia-like condition were dropping. That on top of that, with the suppression of her immune system, she had developed fevers and an infection. They did a CT scan. The CT scan showed that her cancer, her original cancer, had come back and was in her hip again and in her liver. That had further advanced until she became immobilized with pain, and that was when she checked into the hospital. She'd been there now for 2 weeks, in bed, in terrible pain. She'd become incontinent. And what she wanted to know is what she should do. I said, well, what do your doctors say that they can do? And she said, not much. They were giving her blood transfusions to keep her blood counts up. They were giving her pain medications. They were giving her steroids to combat the tumor fevers. They told her there were no established chemotherapy options that could work for her situation. And, you know, I had not been feeling I was very good at knowing what to say in those situations. I also think this is the moment that we debate in our country. What is it that we think she should do? What do we think should happen now? Should we encourage her, should I encourage her, to go for, you know, well, let's look for somewhere that has an experimental therapy. Let's push the doctors to, you know, try something, because there's always something that we can try. You know, she's young, she's got things that she wants to do, and, you know, let's go for, even if it's a lottery ticket's chance, let's go for that. Or should we, as she put it, give up? The doctor said, you know, you can sign up for hospice. They would keep you comfortable. Now, what I knew is that neither seemed quite right. For more than 10 years, though, I hadn't really known of other options, and I didn't feel really effective in finding a pathway through these situations, and it bothered me as a surgeon and now as the son of someone who was facing an incurable tumor that was advancing slowly. And so what I did was researched for several years this book on what has gone wrong with the medical way we treat mortality and what might be better about it. I ended up interviewing over 200 in the end, family members and patients about their experiences with aging and serious illness. I followed scores of palliative care experts and frontline nursing home workers and geriatricians and others. And among the many lessons I felt like I found from talking to them were two fundamental ones. In medicine and society, I came to realize, we fail to recognize that people have priorities besides just living longer. We may care about wanting to maintain our cognitive function in the course of our care, or that, you know, we want to achieve some personal life projects that we want to finish, or that we have a dog that we just want to be with. Who knows? And that's the second lesson that I felt that I recognized. There's detailed evidence about this, which is that the most reliable way to find out people's priorities is to ask. And we don't ask. We do less than a third of the time with people with many terminal conditions. But when I followed people who were comfortable asking and began to understand what they were really good at, when they were effective in asking, what it really meant, often had this question for them. You know, my previous book was The Checklist Manifesto, so I would say, you know, what should be my checklist when I next see a patient? And they would tell me a couple of things. They would say, well, for one thing, you should be talking less than half the time. And so I paid attention, and to my horror, I discovered I was talking 90% of the time. Lots of facts and figures and pros and cons and this and that. You understand, right? Oh, yeah, I understand. And what they suggested, you know, in order to get down to 50% or less, you have to ask questions. And there were a few powerful questions that emerged from my personal checklist. And one is, what is your understanding of your health condition, of how you are doing? Another, what are your fears and worries for the future? What are your goals if your health is worsening? What are the outcomes you'd find unacceptable? And so I asked Peg these questions. Not everyone can answer these kinds of questions, but she was able to. I said, what's your understanding of your condition? And she said flat out, I'm going to die. There's nothing more they can do. I've just been here, just sitting here, and there's nothing more they can do. And there was anger in her voice. She was upset about this. I said, well, what goals do you have if time is short? And she said that she didn't have any that she could see possible. So then I said, what are your fears and worries for the future? And she had a litany. She feared facing more pain. She feared suffering the humiliation of losing more of her bodily control. She feared dying in the hospital. She said she'd been there for days, just getting worse and worse. While I was investigating the book, I had followed hospice workers as they went about their job, hospice nurses and doctors. And what was interesting to me was that they did not see their job, certainly, as giving up. They didn't even see their job as helping to let nature take its course. The way one nurse described it to me that stuck in my head was that she saw her job as doing the opposite of what medicine does. Medicine sacrifices your time and quality of life now for the sake of possible time later. And she said her job was to come in when that is only making matters worse and be able to say, let's use our capabilities to give you the best possible day now, regardless of what it means about how much time you have in the future. So I said to Peg, you know, what if we just tried to fight for, what if we didn't give up? What if we didn't try to fight for more time? What if we just tried to fight for having a good day? It seemed like a really long time since you'd had a good day. She said, yes, it's been a really long time. I said, might that be worth hoping for, that one good day? And Martin, her husband, and I persuaded her to go ahead and try hospice at this point. 48 hours later, she went home, had to break the news to my daughter, Hunter, that she wouldn't have any piano lessons with Peg anymore. I had to explain to her, and it's hard, she was just 13 years old, that it was because Peg was dying. She was struck really low. She said, I want to go see her. And I said, you'll likely not be able to see her again. And then we got a surprising call a couple days later, and it was from Peg. She said, if we were willing and if Hunter were willing, she would like to resume teaching her again on hospice. I mean, that was more than she or I had ever imagined. But her hospice nurse, her name was Deborah French, came and talked to Peg about what she cared about most in her life. And then she worked to try to make it happen. So first, what she cared about was just being free of pain. So she arranged for a hospital bed downstairs on their first floor so she didn't have to navigate the stairs and try to make her way around. She had arranged for a portable commode right by the bedside. The hospice doctor worked with her to adjust the medications. They increased the amount of morphine she was taking, started a new medication called gabapentin, and then added Ritalin to combat the stupor that the medications brought on. And with those, her pain came under control, and she began to lift her sights. Martin later told me that she came to a clear view of how she wanted to live the rest of her days. She was going to be at home, and she was going to teach. Now, that took a lot of planning and great medical expertise to make every lesson possible. The team had to help calibrate her meds. The trick was to give her enough morphine that she could teach, but not so much that she wasn't, you know, groggy and slurring her speech and freaking out the kids. Martin said that she was more alive running up to a lesson and for the days after than he'd seen her in a long time. She'd had no children. Her students filled that place for her. And she still had some things she wanted them to know before she went. She wanted to say her goodbyes, give some parting advice. I think medicine has forgotten how vital those matters are to people as we approach life's end. We have a very narrow idea that health is what everybody wants. That's our priority. But when health isn't achievable, or when there's a bigger idea that people live for, we don't quite know what to do with that. Well, as people approach life's end, they want to share memories. They want to pass on wisdoms and keepsakes. They want to connect with loved ones. They want to make some last contributions to the world. And that role, many people argue, is among life's most important. It's part of how life achieves meaning. And the way we in medicine can deny people these moments, out of obtuseness often, out of neglect or ignorance, I think is cause for our shame. Peg, however, got to fulfill that final role. She lived 6 full weeks. Hunter got lessons for 4 of them. And there were 2 final concerts, one with the children who were being taught, a recital, and one with former students from all over the country who gathered to play a concert for Peg. They gathered in her living room playing Brahms and Dvorak and Chopin and Beethoven, all for their adored teacher. And then a week after that final concert, Peg fell into a delirium, and a week after that died peacefully in her bed. My final remembrance of her, however, is from near the end of the recital with the children. After they'd all played, she stood with each child off from the crowd to give each one a personal gift and a few words. And I saw her when it was Hunter's turn. She gave her a book of music she'd picked out for her to keep and she wanted her to learn. And then she put her arm around her shoulder and gave her one more gift. "You're special," she whispered to her. And that was something she never wanted the kids to forget. Thank you.
So I'm going to go and get started. It seems to me one of the reasons why your book is so well received is that it speaks to the universal. And at the risk of being flippant, the bumper sticker line that comes to mind is, life is a sexually transmitted condition that's invariably fatal. You know? but in all honesty, people have said, you know, Americans think somehow that death is avoidable. How has it come to be that we as a society have such a hard time facing it head on?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things to me, because I ended up doing this research and connecting with people all over the world, a fair amount of the book actually takes place in India, is that there's a variety of research, I think really tied to a woman at Stanford for me named Laura Carstensen, who
looked at how our desires and goals change depending on how close we are to the end of our lives. What she found was that, she did these interesting studies with people wearing beepers, and they were ages 18 to 94, and they would, her team would page them, and whenever they were paged, they would have to write down what their emotions they were, what emotions they were experiencing, what kinds of desires they might have was another set of studies they did. They would ask, if you have half an hour of time to spend with anybody you wanted, who might you want to spend that time with? Would you rather spend it with, the singer of a favorite rock song, or your sister? And the kinds of answers I got back were a kind of young signature and an old signature. And the young signature was that people wanted to, there was a couple things. Number one is that what people wanted and desired was often, getting stuff, achieving stuff, getting public recognition, being connected to a really wide group of people. And when you're older, that people tended to want a smaller, tighter-knit group of people that they had deeper, more intimate connections with. So the younger folks would say, my sister, but the rock star. And the older folks would be like, rock star, schmock star. How about my sister? And the further layer that came out of this was that a lot of the puzzle was around whether, as you got older, you are more likely, was it because your brain, what took so long to figure this out? That's wisdom that you're accumulating along the way. And the thought was maybe it's brain changes, or maybe it's cultural phenomena. And then it happened that her study occurred during 9/11. And during 9/11, everybody switched to the older phenotype. Everybody suddenly wanted to be with family rather than hanging out in some nightclub or seeing some cool new person. They wanted to, when life becomes fragile and uncertain, we move to wanting and caring about these kinds of concerns. We become more aware of the possibility of the end of life. The story of this century, I think, is that because we've added 30 years to people's lives since the beginning of the 1900s, that we're much further away from ever having the experience of mortality be significant in any of our lives. Her work suggests that if you have about 20 years or more in front of you, you might as well think you're immortal. She did an experiment with those elderly folks and found you could manipulate their thinking very easily. She would just tell them, imagine your doctor called and said that there's this amazing new drug, a pill, that adds, for your particular genetic type, adds 20 years to your life at the same health you have now. And the prescription's down at your pharmacy. Now who do you want to spend half an hour with? What do you want to do? And suddenly people want to be achieving and trying these, I'll go to that nightclub again and forget my sister. So the story, I think, that's evolved is that aging was not actually connected to your risk of dying in the 19th century, in the 18th century, or a millennium ago. Your risk of dying at age 5 or age 20 or at age 40 was ever present. George Washington died of a strep throat 3 days after he picked it up. And that meant that you were constantly aware of the fragility of life and thinking about these concerns. And the last part I'll add around this is that, the consequences that we think that a good life is an independent and healthy life, because that's what we know for most of our lives, and that's what we hold out there. But in another time, we understood that, not always being healthy, not always being perfectly abled, that people could have good lives. And in fact, that's the final thing I'll say about Laura Carstensen's work. People's health got worse. People's abilities declined. But the happiest people in those studies were the older people. Rates of depression fell. Anxieties fell. As people got closer to recognizing the fragility of life, they were capable of more complex emotions, poignancy, the idea of having both negative and positive emotions at the same time. And so I think this removal of the experience of dying and the fragility of life behind institutional walls has been not very good for the people who are stuck behind those places, and not very good for society either.
So I actually want to pick up on this idea of perspective and also on the institutions that you raise, because your book is a fairly damning portrayal of kind of the modern day nursing home. And I found it fascinating that nursing homes were never designed with the idea of the elderly in mind. And I just want to, I think you were quoting someone here, but you said, describing the history of nursing homes from the perspective of the elderly is like describing the opening of the American West from the perspective of the mule. They were certainly there, and the epical events were certainly critical to the mules, but hardly anyone is paying much attention to them. Can you actually share with our audience how nursing homes came to be?
Well, I thought the story of the nursing homes would be, boy, we added all these years to people's lives, and we, you know, needed to make a rational institution that would help care for people in the years where you needed, you know, 24-hour help, day help, or those kinds of things. That was not how they got created. They got created because the hospitals in the 1950s and 60s got full of all these folks, and they wanted a way to empty out the beds. And so they created nursing homes. They were called nursing homes precisely because they were meant to fulfill a medical function. And they were never necessarily even acknowledging that people were at the end stage of their lives. They were intended to be places that nursed you back to health. And so the consequence is that we borrowed the medical values of the hospital and brought them into these places. And we gradually turned them from fire traps, neglectful places, into very safe places. But they look like hospitals. You know, they're built with these long halls. You have roommates. You have they're organized around a nurse's station. You know, you have a very regimented institutional life that's safe but empty and without purpose. And people, you know, one pioneer who calls himself a nursing home abolitionist that I wrote about calls it, you know, that people are afflicted with the three plagues: boredom, loneliness, and helplessness. The one group of people as they get older who become more unhappy and more depressed are the ones who are institutionalized.
And so actually, that person who talked about the three plagues, one of the things that I actually found the most hopeful in your book was reading about these, you know, thinking outside the box, new ways of imagining how you can get old, and actually laughed out loud when I read about Bill Thomas's efforts, just at his audaciousness and the creativity. And can you describe the Eden Alternative Project?
Yeah.
It's a great project.
If it's all right, I might read a portion of the book. Yeah. Can I steal your book for a second? Thank you. So Bill Thomas was in upstate New York, and he is a medical director at a nursing home. He just, you know, got that job. He's a bit of a crazy man. He, you know, has his own farm that he runs entirely off the grid. He's a homesteader. So, you know, grows his own food, homeschools his kids, takes no electricity. His ideal was independence, that autonomy in the world meant you were free of anybody's control. And then he goes into a nursing home as a new medical director and realizes, how does that work for these people? And he found it really depressing there. They had the three plagues. And he said, well, I will fix this. And what he wanted to do was fix it the way that it was fixed on his farm, which is that you filled the place with life. And so he wanted to bring animals in. And so he and the nursing home director sat down to fill out some forms to ask for a waiver of the regulations that prevent you from having animals. And he wanted there to be pets. And, you know, the first thing he did was he asked the director if he could put down on the application that they would allow two dogs. And so this is the section. And this is my interview with the director of the nursing home about what it was like when Bill Thomas, you know, suggested this idea. And so he says, I recall the scene vividly. The director of nursing, Lois Greising, was sitting in the room, the activities leader and the social worker, and I can see the three of them sitting there looking at each other, rolling their eyes, saying, this is going to be interesting. I said, all right, I'll put it down. I'll put the two dogs down for this application. I was beginning to think, I'm not really into this as much as you are, but I'll put two dogs down. And then he said, now what about cats? I said, what about cats? We've got two dogs down on the paper. He said, some people aren't dog lovers. They like cats. I said, you want dogs and cats? He said, let's put it down for discussion purposes. I said, okay, I'll put a cat down. No, 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 no. We're two floors. How about two cats on both floors? I said, we want to propose to the health department two dogs and four cats. He said, yes, yes, just put it down. I said, all right, I'll put it down. I think we're getting off base here. This is not going to fly with them. He said, one more thing. What about birds? I said, the code states clearly, no birds allowed in nursing homes. He said, but what about birds? I said, what about birds? He said, just picture, look out your window right here. Picture we're in January or February. We have 3 feet of snow outside. What sounds do you hear in the nursing home? I said, well, you hear some residents moaning. You probably hear some laughter. You hear televisions on in different areas, maybe a little more than we'd like them to be. I said, you'll hear an announcement over the PA system. What other sounds are you hearing? Well, you're hearing staff interacting with each other and with residents. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But what are those sounds that are sounds of life, of positive life? You're talking birdsong? Yes! I said, how many birds are you talking to create this birdsong? He said, let's put down 100. 100 birds in this place? You got to be out of your mind. Have you ever lived in a house that has two dogs and four cats and 100 birds? And he said, no. But wouldn't it be worth trying? Now that's the crux of the difference between Dr. Thomas and me. The other three were sitting in that room, their eyes were bugging out of their heads now, and they were saying, oh my God, do we want to do this? I said, Dr. Thomas, I am into this. I want to think outside the box, but I don't know that I want to look like a zoo or smell like a zoo. I can't picture doing this. And he said, would you just hang with me? Well, he finally relented, thinking, four dogs, two cats, 100 birds. The state regulators are going to knock this down. There's no way. So he said, okay, okay, we'll send it in. Well, Thomas went to Albany, New York, to the state capitol, and did the same thing to the regulators, and they approved it. And then he said, you know, if I just bring the dogs in one day, they're going to shut down all the rest. So he brought all of them in on one day. Two dogs, four cats, 100 birds. And it was complete chaos. But everybody had an animal of their own to care for, even Alzheimer's patients. And it pulled them out of themselves. They had purpose in their days. Medication use went down. Survival rates actually went up. That's what it means to say that we live for something more than just being alive.
Yeah. So can I pick up on, I did have another question. I am going to get to audience questions in a second, but you know, this, you said medications went down, hospitalizations, I mean, you cite study after study in your book that about the positive impact of geriatric teams, palliative care specialists, assisted living programs, you know, decreasing disability, depression, hospitalization, even increasing life expectancy. And you actually even made the point that if there were a device that could achieve these outcomes, like an automatic defrailer, I think you called it,
yeah,
like everybody would be up in arms, like everybody needs one of these, you know, going to Congress, and instead they're shutting down geriatrics teams. You know, how can we turn the table on this and actually actually practice evidence-based medicine?
Right. I think partly I was trying to understand, number one, is there the automatic defrailer? And the answer is yes. And it consists of this very low-tech set of ideas, which are around conversations that identify what people's priorities are, and then the effort to instill the skills and capabilities that allow people to maintain them. A lot of the time, it doesn't cost more money. You know, the imagination to bring dogs and cats in and take care of them. Or another innovation, I went to a place that allowed instead of building the rooms around a nurse's station, built it around a kitchen, and you could go in the kitchen and you could get whatever you wanted. And, you know, that's controversial because suppose a diabetic goes in the refrigerator and gets a soda pop. Well, that's not safe. And the idea that you could have autonomy to make choices that weren't necessarily good for you is, you know, a powerful thing that we call home. That's what you're allowed to do in your home. It's, you know, it's the place that we get to. And so I think the thing that holds us back, yes, there are policies in place. I actually don't think the regulations prevent this. It's how we are interpreting them, because now I describe innovators in virtually every state in the country now who are building these kinds of places that are and services in homes to keep people being able to have much more choice and autonomy. I think the major barrier is our imaginations. We don't imagine that when you need to be in a wheelchair, or when you are sick, or when you might be in pain, like Peg Batchelder with a terminal condition, that there's any space left for something you'd call a good life. And when we understand that all it takes is helping elicit and understand what people's priorities and goals could be under those circumstances, I think that unlocks the possibilities. So yes, there's, I'd love to see investment in many of these innovators. They aren't the same kinds of innovators you see in Silicon Valley. They aren't building a new mobile technology device. They're just building ways to help make it possible that you can have a better life. I'd love to see physicians get paid and supported for payment to have these conversations with you about your priorities and goals in case you get sicker, or in fact, when you get sicker. We should make it financially feasible to have these incredibly valuable conversations that add huge value in the health system as well, reduce costs in the long run as well. And I think the barriers are that our imaginations lead us to think all you're really doing is you're taking away life from people. And that's why, I didn't write this as a scientific journal article. It's a book. It's meant to try to connect the stories of what we are aiming for with the evidence.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Dr. Atul Gawande about his work and new book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End, which examines the modern experience of mortality. I am Dr. Chen, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. So I want to pick up on this, something that actually has been shown to work, shared decision-making, which is a little bit of a trendy concept in health policy circles now. And in my experience, it's easier said than done. And it actually, your description of Dr. Benzel, your father's neurosurgeon, is one of the most clear examples that I've seen, and it kind of dovetails into one of our audience questions. How do doctors make the time to learn about their patients' priorities? Aren't they incredibly busy already? How do they know what to ask? And Dr. Benzel seemed to know what to ask.
Yeah. How do you make the time to help unlock the priorities that people have? I mean, how do we make the time to do anything right in medicine? This couldn't be anything that's more important. And so I came at it by thinking about it in a couple of ways. I think the concept of what the job of a doctor is has changed enormously over the last half century. 50 years ago, the job of the doctor was doctor knows best. It was a paternalistic ideal. The doctor might or might not tell you how sick you are, wouldn't tell you about your options, would just say, here's what we're going to do to you. And in the 70s and 80s, we rebelled against that. And we came to a place where by the time I was in medical school training in the 90s, it was a ideal that we regarded as a kind of, I call it the informative doctor. That you are, it's almost a retail model. Here is the option A and here's option B, the red pill and the blue pill. Here are the pros and the cons and the risks and the benefits. What do you want to do? And I was actually taught that when people then say to you, and they often say it to you, well, what would you do, doctor? That you're supposed to say, well, it's not about me. It's really about you. So, it's your choice. It's your call. And people feel a little abandoned in those circumstances. Then, in fact, what people want is a counselor, someone who, the term for it is shared decision making, which I didn't really understand what it was until I came to see people like Ed Benzel, who is the neurosurgeon, talk to my father. The other neurosurgeon we consulted was someone who, gave my dad the options. He sort of first tried the paternalistic mode of saying, you should have an operation, you should have it today. My dad made him spell out all the options, and he switched to the informative mode. Well, we could put off the surgery and you could be paralyzed, or you could have the surgery now and we'd, minimize the risk of paralysis. But yes, there's a 25% chance of major complications, like paralysis. okay, so now what do we do? And what Benzel did was he first asked, tell me about your life. and ask those kinds of questions. You know, what are your fears and what are your worries? And it became clear my father's first priority was he wanted to stay a surgeon. My dad's a surgeon as long as he could and wanted an option that was not going to risk taking that away. And they decided to take the chance that the tumor would advance and make him, you know, catastrophically paralyzed and wait for surgery. As it turned out, he waited 2.5 years without it advancing, and it was a risk that they agreed was a wise one to take. And then he had to end his practice because the paralysis advanced, and that was when he went for the surgical option. And that kind of way of going about it and his way of being and being comfortable with his with the uncertainty of the situation, but identifying the priorities and goals that somebody has and then fighting for it is the really cool, I thought, interesting thing, and became something that I wanted to try to make more like the way I practice too.
I'm going to read this first and just give you the context of it. Do you have conflicts with your colleagues given your atypical or new philosophy of care? And what I would say is I'm biased, but my sense is that primary care providers, I'm a PCP, do have these conversations, not nearly early enough or frequently enough, but we do have them. What I find really interesting is there's a small group of people who are unlikely specialists. So I know someone who's a critical care physician, someone who's a dialysis physician, surgeons, who are actually really engaging and embracing this. What kind of pushback are you getting, and what kind of advice would you give to those people to forge ahead?
Well, I think at the abstract, there is sometimes pushback, and colleagues of mine have called it, you know, you're just a nihilist. You're not acknowledging that there's any kind of, you know, we're having breakthroughs. This is an incredible period in biotechnology, and I'm not. I mean, I'm a tech kind of guy. I love what we get to do technologically in surgery. And I think as the book has gone out and I've been able to make the argument that it really is about what you're fighting for with that technology, those arguments have really melted away. I had more pushback as people heard about the subject of the book and what I might be arguing than I'm now getting now that it finally is out. And when we realize that the question is, you know, what are we fighting for? That medicine has been so focused on averting death that we've forgotten about what it means to fight for life. And when we understand the priorities, well, you might be fighting for someone to get to a wedding in a month, which means you want to avoid something that has complications that would prevent that from happening now. Or you might be fighting for someone who says, look, you know, one of my colleagues has a father who said, if I can watch football on television and eat chocolate ice cream, that's going to be good enough for me. Like, that's the best living will I've ever heard. It's not what I don't want, it's what I do want with whatever comes along.
Yeah. So there are a number of questions here about political controversy, you know, the whole Sarah Palin death panel issue, cost. And what's interesting is approaching end of life in the way you're advocating for, which is really trying to understand what makes life meaningful, avoiding kind of the lottery ticket mentality of kind of the rare cure, turns out to be one of the few areas in medicine where we can really hit that triple aim. So improving patient experience, outcomes, and actually reducing costs. But as soon as the cost issue comes up, all this death panel rhetoric starts flowing. So what would be your thoughts in terms of how do we actually either engage or do we sidestep it? How do we address this issue that people are concerned that this is a way to save costs?
Yeah. One of the concerns I have is that that if it's just about saving costs, it can actually be sacrificing the priorities and values that people have. It is a happy consequence that where we are now with a tremendous amount of wasteful and painful spending, because we can always offer yet another treatment. It's a happy consequence that it can meet the triple aim, but it's a secondary goal. So here I'll give you as an example. There's a number of studies that have shown this, but probably the most rigorously done one was from the Mass General Hospital that looked at terminal lung cancer patients, stage 4 patients who had on average 11 months that they lived in the study. Half of them were assigned to have usual oncology care, and the other half were assigned to have usual oncology care, plus seeing a palliative care specialist who would have these kinds of discussions with patients. And, you know, they looked at, you know, did it make people more depressed? Did it make them more anxious to have these discussions? And it didn't at all. One of the fascinating consequences, however, was that they were much more likely to stop chemotherapy sooner when they had these conversations than those who didn't. They were much less likely to go on to that fourth round of last-ditch chemotherapy. They had one-third fewer days in the hospital, started hospice sooner. They were much less likely to be in the ICU at the end of life. Overall costs were about one-third lower. Their suffering was lower. But they lived, on average, 25% longer. And that just means we've been making poor decisions. When you give that last-ditch therapy, that last-ditch operation, I've done a lot of operations for people in their last week of life. In fact, the last week of life is your most likely week in your life to have an operation. And, you know, you'd like to move it up a little bit. When you give it at that stage where it's a last-ditch effort, you're mostly giving the toxicity and none of the benefit, and arriving at ways that we're making that a more sensible discussion and gamble requires us understanding what are we prioritizing. It's not about taking away. It's about what our goals and priorities are for having as good a life as possible at that last phase.
So when we talk about the last phase, inevitably, and about a third of the questions that have come in are actually about this, the issue of physician-assisted suicide or right to die comes up. And so a number, again, about a third of these questions are about, having the ability to die when you want to can relieve anxiety, relieve worry. The death with dignity law in Oregon is seen by some as a real something to emulate in other states. What are your thoughts on physician-assisted suicide?
So I've come to complicated views about it. I think that people who have unbearable suffering should be given the option that they could have an assisted death. In Oregon and Washington, it's done with a careful procedure that has led to just 1% of the population choosing to have that kind of a prescription. And what's interesting is only half end up using it because of the relief that that questioner points out, the relief of knowing that there is a pathway if your suffering becomes unbearable, that the option is there on your shelf. Now, where I get complicated is that I think that that percentage of people who end up choosing assisted suicide should be regarded as a failure of the health system, that those are people we have failed to relieve their burden of suffering. And I'm alarmed by the idea that our goal is a good death. I don't think our goal is a good death. I think our goal is as good a life as possible all the way to the very end. And there are consequences if we think about it as a good death. You know, in the Netherlands, the first country to have adopted this kind of approach, the percentage of people at death who end up choosing this pathway is closing in on around 4%. And the most common reason that they say that they want to take this path is they don't want to be a burden on others. And that worries me. It worries me even more that the Netherlands was one of the late countries to develop a hospice and palliative care system to allow people more options for being able to have something other than suffering at the end of life. And this debate is going on very intensively in India about assisted death. In India, cancer patients are not given narcotics at the end of life. I saw surgery patients when I visit there, you know, that often are given only Tylenol for orthopedic surgery or for abdominal surgery. So if you have a terminal cancer, you're in terrible pain, and no one's doing anything about it, would you be surprised if wouldn't you want assisted death, like something to put you out of the misery? But each one of those are a failure of the health system. And that, so I am supportive of assisted death, but it's with the understanding that assisted living is harder than assisted death, and each death chosen for that pathway is our failure to have developed capabilities that relieve people of the suffering that they experience, or to deploy the known capabilities that can relieve people of that suffering.
So this issue of assisted living. One of the questions I have here is, many of us are trying to figure out how to best support our aging parents who are still living at home. How can we best support them before institutional approaches are considered, perhaps delaying this transition? And so I think about, you know, your description of assisted living being Karen Brown Wilson's inspired vision of assisting people who, for whatever reason, were becoming debilitated or more dependent, actually live, you know, assisted living. But it's actually largely morphed into a way station for nursing homes, commercialized. How did this happen? What can we do to change it? And for people who are looking for a real assisted living situation, what options do they have?
Well, Karen Brown Wilson was one of the originators of assisted living, and it's remarkably young as a field. It's only about 2 decades ago that the first one really got built in Portland, Oregon, during the early 90s. And the concept was that, you know, she was 19 years old when her mom had a stroke at age 55, became someone who needed 24-hour care, but was very intact and treated in a way that suggested she was nothing but a patient. She was not a person. And she said, you know, if I really had my own place, I'd have a little kitchenette. I'd be allowed to lock the door when I wanted and have a little privacy. I'd be, I'd have my own clothes. I'd have my own furniture that I wanted. I could keep my stack of National Geographic magazines without somebody cleaning it out and calling it junk. You know, I would have my own home. And so she created assisted living as a replacement for her, you know, Karen Wilson created as a replacement for the nursing home, as a place that you could get enough services, but it would be treated as your home. And what emerged, what evolved, was that the problem was the kids. The adult kids are the people who predominantly make the decisions. The parents tend to turn over the decisions to the kids about where they will be. And what do we ask when we go in? Are you going to be safe? We want the safety ratings, but don't ask very much about, you know, how do you go about it assuring that you're able to assist people with what they would call life? You know, can they stay connected to the friends that they have? Can they still go to the church that they go to rather than that milquetoast, non-denominational, whatever it is downstairs? You know, can they have some connection and purpose in life? And Karen said this great thing to me. She said, safety is what we want for those we love, and autonomy is what we want for ourselves. And so the market has evolved to serve what the kids want and not what the parents want, because the parents aren't the buyers. Now, I have a feeling the baby boom generation might change that dynamic and insist that that's being bought for them. But if they don't, I also think that the adult child population needs to understand that. And she had some advice in thinking about, you know, when you even look in these places, that you're asking questions about, you know, not about how you deal with safety, but what's your plan for dealing with the three plagues, loneliness and boredom and helplessness? How do they connect to the person that you know and help them remain the person that you know?
So speaking of the aging of the baby boomers, it's been described as a silver tsunami with roughly 8,000 turning 65 daily. And at the same time, and this is a shout out to the geriatricians, geriatrics may be the only specialty where you make less the more you train, right? And this is a question, I mean, so this is a comment from one of the geriatricians in the office. When you say many patients have surgery in their last week of life, just remember that's your patients. Mine as a geriatrician almost never have surgery at all. So you point out that the number of geriatricians has dropped by 25% in recent years. Clearly these trends are not in alignment. What do we do?
Well, there's a couple things. One is, you know, it's fascinating to me that I didn't know really what a geriatrician was. I had the geriatrics clinic on the first floor right below my surgical clinic, and I'd never once gone in there. And so, you know, I went in one day and I said, like, can I hang out, see what you do? And I'm allowed to do that because I'm a writer, because if you just did that as a fellow doctor, you'd be like, you're weird. But I go, I'm writing a book. Can I follow you around? They're like, oh, yeah, sure. And the geriatrician is the person who is willing and able to deal with, I found, all of the range of problems that an elderly person has, many of which you cannot fix, but you can sometimes manage. And the kinds of skills that they have are ones that we don't teach in medical schools. You know, 97% of medical schools don't provide any geriatric skills. And an example of this that really struck me was, you know, you'd have a person, she was in her 80s, who, as I looked at her, I thought the biggest risk that she faced was that there was a chest x-ray that showed a possible lung nodule, that she'd had polyps in the past, and, you know, should she have a colonoscopy or not might be a discussion that we needed to have, and her arthritis was really acting up, and you know, maybe there's some medication for that, and we should pick one of those and work on it. And what he zeroed in on was the fact that she was at tremendous risk of falling, that in talking to her, she'd in fact been having some falls, and that was the most dangerous thing for her quality of life, for what she cared about in her life, which was living in her apartment independently as long as she could. And he knew the three risk factors, which I didn't know, which are things like being on four drugs or more, or having weakness, and, you know, it's called the get up and go test. Can they get up out of the chair and just go without having to push yourself up out of the chair? And if you can't pass the get up and go test, that's another risk factor for falling. And he examined her feet incredibly carefully, paid more attention to her feet than anywhere else, and, you know, showed me how to examine the feet, the calluses that can make a difference and make a person unstable, and then made a plan for her that addressed each of those issues, reduced her medications, worked on nutrition for her, got a podiatrist to deal with the sores on her feet. A year later, I talked to her, and she'd had no more falls since that visit and was still living independently in that apartment. And her risks were, had been, you know, very high for a fall in 6 months. Those are the kinds of capabilities we're talking about. Now, what we're in, when we have a situation where we have fewer geriatricians being trained now than we trained 20 years ago, as one geriatrician said, it's too late. We can't solve the problem by having geriatricians suddenly increase in number. And instead, what we have to do is make those skills part of what every physician knows how to deal with, especially primary care physicians that you might have. No one is crying out for geriatricians because you have to admit that you're old. You know, taking mom to the geriatrician, like, you know, she's not going to like you that day. And yet it has all those incredible benefits along the way, right? So we have to make it normal, but also make those skills that we carry into the rest we do. And I think that starts from medical school and goes onward into training and even into additional training in people who are already in career and in practice 10, 15, 20 years later.
Yeah. So I see, you know, at our medical school, I suspect across the country, there has been more of a focus on end-of-life issues, but it's actually rather perfunctory. It's actually very much in the electronic health record, you check this box if there's an advance directive, you fill in this blank if there's a healthcare proxy, the conversations themselves oftentimes take the form of a multiple choice test. You know, do you want A, B, C, or all of the above? Right? And so I'm getting some questions about really practical things, like what works in end-of-life planning? I have one here, how does one avoid being taken to the hospital? You know, DNR does not work. Would it help to make a video? Like, what are the things that you've seen actually work in end-of-life planning?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One is, I think we're the expectation that it's always going to work perfectly. I think there are systems that can be put in, and but I'm hesitant about them. So on one level, I would say, look, you know, Oregon has been a pioneer at this. They have made it so that you can have your instructions about life-sustaining therapy and orders like do not resuscitate actually loaded into an electronic database so that all the EMTs have access to it and then don't suddenly come to your house and shock you. that those things, I think, are important systemic things, systemic capabilities that we can build in. But I think at the first level, what comes before that and has been powerful in places like Oregon, Wisconsin, and other communities that have been able to make this work is that it's just simply having the conversation that I talked about earlier, being willing to talk to your own family member about, well, you know, what are your fears and worries? What are your goals? What would it mean to be able to, what kind of life is worth living for you and what kind of life isn't worth living? Because more often than not, 70% of us will come to that moment and need someone else to speak for us because we can't. And those people are rarely equipped with the information. My wife and I had this discussion, and we turned out to have shockingly different views on this subject. My view of it was, if I'm a brain in a jar, connected up to some kind of sensory equipment that allows me to, you know, perceive the world and to communicate with, back and forth with others, hear things and speak, well, that's good enough for me. If I'm just a healthy-seeming body, but my brain is gone, I'm not who I was, let me go. My wife's view is, that's stupid. Kathleen's like, look, if I look happy, that is good enough for me. And now I know. It makes the job but much easier if we come to that. You have to have these conversations more than once because people change their minds along the way. We adapt to certain circumstances. With experience, we have a different view of things. But we have to make that a normal part of our world.
So you have really impeccable timing with your book because the Institute of Medicine just released a report entitled Dying in America, Improving Quality and Honoring Individual Preferences Near the End of Life. It sounds many of the same themes in your book. Is there anything that you think is missing in that report or that you would particularly want to highlight?
Well, I think the dying, it came out just a month ago, and it's a 507-page compendium of all of the evidence about the ways in which we're failing at the end of life. And what's great is that it was a much more comprehensive overview of the science than I ever managed to get to, because that 500 pages distills tens of thousands of pages of information, and we were fortunately aligned in all of the same ways. I feel like the thing, they're almost, I feel like, companions in a way, because what I hoped to do was tell the stories behind the data of what it's like to try to use that kind of information and apply it in day-to-day life, whether as a doctor, as a family member, and also what it was like when you don't have that kind of information available. And, you know, I think the parts that are missing are a little bit of, well, how do I do that? Okay, conversations are powerful, but what kind of conversation and what are the words? And that was a lot of what I was looking for behind talking to people and not just looking at the data, was how do I get the words to talk to my father or talk to my patient who I have to really break bad news for? And, you know, some of those skills and lessons that people had are really powerful, like learning to not just give people the data about survival rates and so on, but instead to be able to use words like, I'm worried. I'm worried about what this means. It conveys that you care, that you're not certain that you're going to die, you know, in 6 months, but that you're worried. And that leaves open many possibilities, but also some direction for going forward. And so that report, I think, was phenomenally important. And I think part of a wave of a variety of information that suggests we are way beyond death panels now and willing to engage at a national level with transforming our institutions to work better for us.
That's great. So all too soon, we've reached the point in our program where there's only one last question. So I just want to go back to that first point, which is, you know, this, again, is a universal experience. We all have loved ones who age and who die, and we all will hopefully age, but we will die. If you had an opportunity to do a PSA for the American public, what would it be?
I feel like it would just be the story of Peg Batchelder, you know, or a few of any of a number of people that I write about in the book, because I think that chance to be able to help people understand that even when life is incredibly narrow and limited, that the medical view of, well, survival is the goal, is the priority, that it can turn out to be incredibly narrow and can cause suffering and fail to acknowledge suffering. But the wider view that says you can even have priorities and hopes for what you can have accomplished in that time that you have left for you or and with you, that can be a transformative experience for many, many people, and it can be the kind of It can be a capstone of your life, and it can turn out to simply be the way we give our life meaning. I think that's the important idea.
Thank you. Our thanks to Dr. Atul Gawande for coming to talk about his work and his new book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I am Dr. Alice Chen, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.